have been talking about dark energy, and we'll try to finish that up today and talk about the cosmology constant problem. That is still a very active research area right now. Nobody knows the answer. Well, lots of people have lots of proposals. And we'll start, as we say, that we should go back in time. And we'll start to talk about structure formation today and wrap it up on Monday. Okay. So cosmology constant problem. Why is it a problem? We just showed that in various cases, such as the age of the universe or observations of supernovae, that it's a good thing to have this. So it fits the data. And the problem is, of course, when you try to explain it. So as we mentioned, that the rho lambda. Okay, today we're going to do some order of magnitude estimation, so it's a basically approximate to the critical density. And one way of thinking about the critical density is there is a few hydrogen in the cubic meter. The few is 1/10, it doesn't matter. Okay, so we want to estimate, we'll try to use it another unit to compare with something else we're going to write down. So hydrogen is basically a proton, which is 1 GeV in our all converting everything to electrovolts kind of approach. So that's the approach of taking h bar equals c equals 1. Then there's only one thing, which is called energy. So mass is energy because c equals 1. So in this way, the mass is the same as energy and the length and the time is inverse energy. And this is because E times T, delta E times delta T is H bar. And the length follows from the C equals 1, 2. So everything is energy. You can measure everything in terms of energy. Okay, and then if you look it up, then you can just use these things to convert things. Then you know like hydrogen mass is something like 10 to the minus 27 kilogram. And if you can convert that into electrovolts, this is how much it is. And then you can do the same thing. So then we introduced, of course, we're talking about gravity now. So you can even introduce an even more superior system, taking the Newton's constant also equals to 1. And now you will be able to define something called the Planck. There is a Planck energy and Planck, which is the scale that we definitely know things are going to fail, which is at 10 to the 19 GeV. On 10 to the 18 depends on if you ask particle physicists or you ask cosmologists or you ask, they have some conventions. But it's something big like that. And you also learned something called the Planck lens is something like 10 to the minus 35 meter. And these things are just basically, you have three constants and you have some units. And if you want to combine these three lens into a unit of Planck, you can do that. You combine to get an energy, you can do that. And then you can get the relationship. And then there is a Planck time too. And the upshot of this is I can convert 1/meter into 10 to the minus 7 electron volts. So this is basically says 1/, because they are all the same thing, so this should be equal. The 1/ Planck length should be equal to Planck mass. And if you set them equal, you can relate the length to electron volts. And then if you use this conversion factor, The upshot is this thing itself is equals to 10 to the minus 3 electron loss to the force. All you can just really just plug in the scientific unit, scientific unit and the calculator number, and convert that number to electrons because we know how many electron volts there is in a joule. So, this is, it's a calculator calculation. You can also just ask Google, says convert units to GeV for me, and then you will find a Google calculator. And they will tell you, whenever you see any units, you can express it in GeV. And the point is, if you do that, you will find that this is our today's value. And I decided not to do that on the board because it's just a bunch of numbers converting to each other. Okay, what I can try to do is how we predict it. We learned a QFT. Actually, this is interesting because in QFT, a popular a popular interview question is say, oh, where is the vacuum bubbles? And you guys all say, oh, but we divided by this Z0 and they all disappear. So at first, the quantum field theorists in general decided this thing must be the vacuum energy we always ignore. So if there is a vacuum energy, it's probably a constant, and then it can behave as a cosmology constant, or our problem will be solved. And they happily set off to calculate what is the vacuum bubble. So we can just do a vacuum bubble. Here is a vacuum bubble. When using that lambda 5-4 theory, this is a bubble. And we can estimate what this bubble contributes. So there is a p square, and there is probably a p prime square. And then I have two loop integral. So there's T41 and the T4k prime. And then you see that there's 8 powers up, 4 powers down. So this is proportional to k to the fourth. And then we can take a cutoff. And we have no evidence that any of the standard model theory does not work until Planck scale. So we can just assume we can take a Planck scale as cutoff. But the Planck scale definitely doesn't work because we don't know how to express relativity, general relativity in the QFT scheme. So we happily take this to be Planck to the fourth, which is something like 10 to the 19 GeV to the fourth. Well, so this is rho vacuum energy. And now we see we are slightly off. This is the observed value, and this is the theoretical value. We are off by something like 10 to the 120. See, if you're off by that much, so any point of your calculation, if you make a factor of 2 or 10 or 100 off, it doesn't really matter. So this is how our understanding of the cosmology constant stands. And you know, supersymmetry people always like to say that it's like supersymmetry is such a nice symmetry that this universe, our universe must have it because it's so pretty. And then their proposal is that we'll propose that every particle has a counterparticle such that they contribute somehow always with a minus sign. So then the plus sign, minus sign cancel, then we have supersymmetric universe proposed this value is 0. Well, 0 is certainly much, much better than off by this much, except we are not 0. And the second problem is SUSY. We know it's broken, otherwise we're not here. And we know it's pretty badly broken because we haven't seen anything with our collider, which is at the TeV scale to the fourth. Well, if we believe in SUSY, we can bring this number down 10 to the 60. So, well, that's some success. Okay, so, well, this is a problem. And it's called the old cosmology constant problem. So it's not the only problem we're facing. So basically, at this point, people doing this calculation, and then they were just like, okay, great. Why don't we just believe that there is some symmetry to forbid this number ever exist and set it to be zero? And of course, the supernovae experiment comes and says, no, it's not zero. It's that number. It's this number. It's really not zero. If it's zero, then something else has to be fixed because that's the one that fits the observation. Okay, so the question is, how can we do something to predict it not to be off by that much? So this is the one big problem. And the second problem, well, it's actually really good for us, but we kind of think it is a problem. It's more like a problem of luck. It feels like we're too lucky. So after we discover we do have this cosmology constant, so here is a mini version of the straight line that I don't know how to draw. And this is when dark energy take over. And here, this is not to scale, but here is where galaxy form. It's just like they are only different by a couple of three, maybe a very few billion years. So dark energy and the matter behaves very differently. The matter's, if we're going backwards in time, that it grows as a to the cube. So the chance for these two things to be off order the same at magnitude is really a very small window. And this window happened to this dark energy taking over point happened to happen after the galaxy formation is known as also a CC problem, but it's called the cosmic coincident problem. Ask the question, why these two events happen at the same time? Because what astrophysicists studied is that if this happened, if dark energy take over before the first galaxies are formed, then we're done. They are just, because they expand the universe this fast, you are not going to form anything. So this has to be happening in this order. And also they are very close for some reason. So, and then there is one approach proposed by Steven Weinberg, is that we can actually solve this problem if we take an anthropic approach, which is often frowned upon by true scientists. So this approach, okay, the way to frame it is to make it people to frown upon you is that we observe cosmology constant is at this value is because we are here to observe them. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. So, you know, so when we do science, we hope you know how a truck is gonna go up and down and fall onto the floor has nothing to do with the experimental list. If the observer doesn't exist, we still think some of the physical laws should hold. So this is sort of considered non-scientific way of dealing with this problem until Steven Weinberg make it a very quantitatively, or at least way more quantitatively than I just stated. So basically, what they do is they say, let's assume that lambda takes over after first the galaxy forms. Because let's be honest, if there's no galaxies, there's no us. There might be other form of things, beings. But if we're talking about us as observers, if this doesn't happen, then it's all over. So this assumption itself already made a dramatic improvement of that number. You bring this, all that, all the way down to 200. So if our today's dark energy density, this, is merely 200 times the matter density, then dark energy would be taking too early for galaxy to form. And then there's actually a lower bound too. This we actually have studied in our first tutorial. Says if you have a dark energy that is a negative number, then universe will collapse. And if the universe collapses before any sort of galaxy or life is formed, well, we're not going to be here to observe it too. So then this bound is given re-collapse would, if you don't have this bond, it would re-collapse before life has a chance to form. And this gave you a lower bound. That lower bound is really strict. Okay, so we're doing, you know, order of, you know, 58 organs compared to the 60. So we're getting close just by insist that we are able to exist. But then it's still not quite satisfying, because if you assume rho lambda actually takes an even possibility value between all this value given, then it's 200 to about a 1. So our galaxy is still, like our universe is still excluded with 95% of confidence level. So then they take this one more step, says that also this kind of argument has to assume the fact that we could have other cosmology constants. So that their ideas really think big, bigger than our observable universe. And imagine that the big real universe have a different region of parts, and they could take any cosmology constant value you can imagine. And then they are trying to argue that for a typical observable universe, if we are a typical observer in a typical galaxy, in a typical universe, if we observe this cosmology constant, this is actually natural. So before we believe that is a natural number, but if you impose that there has to be an observer to observe it, the argument what is more likely to be true is actually they are roughly at the same order. So what do they do? Is they write down something called the probability of cosmology constant. And then this is given by some prior distribution. Okay, let me explain this. So this says that remember that the big universe is carved into different regions, and different region has different cosmology constant. And this tells us the volume of universe, which is infinite, nevertheless, set the volume of universe, the cosmology constant, lie in this interval. And then the next thing is to multiply by the number of the galaxy that's going to form if the cosmology constant is this value. So basically, this is a probability density. This is the probability distribution described that if you pick a certain rho lambda, how many galaxies it's going to form. And if we are a typical observer in a typical galaxy, we should be, so this thing should have a peak. Because remember, these are the ones very stringent boundary condition. This is just a few galaxies form, the other ones are almost collapsing. So the distribution must look like and they have the peak. And we assume that we are, you know, not special, we're typical in this sense. And then they read off where the peak value is. It happened to be off order of the matter density. So that actually sort of predict, yeah.
Sorry, I don't understand what that is, the probability distribution for.
So this one or this whole thing? Both.
Either.
Okay, so this one says, so this one assume that we have a, maybe people can call it a multiverse, or it's the big universe that, because like the size of our observable the universe we can observe is a certain size, but beyond that, we just don't know, but there might be things exist. So this theory relies on the fact that this big universe, including the things we can't observe, has different bubbles, and each bubble have different cosmology constant. They treat this as a stochastic variable. So they're just like doing random variable analysis. And it says, you know, it's a random distribution. And then this number says that the volume, or you can say, if you make them all equal size, the number of the pocket universe that happen to have the cosmic constant you pick. So that's a prior. Like this is a prior distribution that nobody knows what they are.
Never mind.
Okay, so the Stephen Weinberg has this argument that says, look, if you think the typical value of the rho lambda is this much bigger than we really want, and we only want like a 200 out of a 10 to the 120, because this region is so extremely teeny, so maybe this prior is flat. So this, the first thing they do is take it to be constant. And then there are a lot of follow-up paper and trying to actually have some motivation for that prior. But for the first analysis, just say that, look, you are only worrying about, it's like linear analysis, you only worry about this teeny region of the vast possibility of rho lambda. So maybe this probability is constant. So within this teeny amount of rho lambda, has any chance of being observed, maybe they are equally distributed. Like, the equal number of pocket universe have this kind of rho lambda. And then the second factor is count galaxies. Once you have rho lambda, then it's very like easy for the experts to tell you how many galaxies are going to be formed, like density of the galaxies. And then this whole thing tells you that for each rho lambda, how many galaxies is going to form, averaged over the whole vast infinite universe.
So is that what the probability distribution on the left is?
That's on the number of galaxies, averaged over all these different pocket universes.
They don't overlap, right?
They can't. They have different cosmology.
Shouldn't they overlap different observable universes?
Yeah. Actually, it's called the bubble collision. You have this kind of vacuum that I've actually met. Johnson, it's an expert study that if our bubble collide with another bubble, how can we observe that? Yeah, good question, yeah. They do. Well, they didn't observe it colliding, but this is an awesome question to ask, is yes. So you can propose that. Okay, so of course the question left is how do you actually, you know, produce, first of all, how do you have a mechanism to produce, you know, all sorts of pocket universe? Before they just assume, we're studying random variables, but then if you want the theory really work, you have to have a proposal. Yeah.
Sorry, one last question. Yeah. Is the curve which peaks at rho lambda the same as rho m, the number of galaxies, or the probability distribution for rho lambda?
I think it's this.
That one?
Yeah.
So,
no, but this is a calculation. See, this is the calculation of, it's just the number of galaxies at a certain rho lambda weighted by how probable that the rho lambda is. Except in the first approximation, we take that to be constant. So this is with the constant prior says all universes are equal, then this is really just a function of the number. It's really just a probability distribution of the number of galaxy depends on rho lambda, if you take a flat prior.
So, so the peak.
So basically, if we are a typical galaxy, so we're probably among those galaxies that happens more often than the rest. Yeah, so it's like that. We should leave here, and this is all in the region of that they are of the same order of magnitude.
So on the x-axis there is the number of galaxies, right?
So I think it's y-axis is the number of galaxies, and this is rho lambda. And then there is like 200 of them, then there is not many galaxies forming, and there is minus one, then they are recollapsing, so there's not many. It's really at a region that it peaks somewhere, and it peaks at where we live right now.
But that's like that peak is where there's the right.
Okay. Yeah, I can read the paper more carefully to figure out what exactly that the probability density is. Yeah.
It's just Bayes' theorem, right? You're expressing the probability of having a certain lambda,
mm-hmm.
given that we exist,
mm-hmm.
so given a certain lambda,
mm-hmm.
how high is the probability that we exist?
Mm-hmm. You are much better at expressing what. Very good. Can you make your statement louder again,
okay,
so that
everybody?
Yeah.
The conditional probability for a certain rho lambda. Under the assumption that we exist.
Mm-hmm.
And on the right-hand side is a bunch of stuff. And the important thing is, how high is the probability that we exist under the assumption of a certain lambda, which is basically the number of galaxies, right?
So, thank you. So then, of course, that this thing become more interesting, and well, still people frown upon it, says, because why would we believe that, you know, there's such a large universe that have all this pocket universe? We think, why wouldn't the universe just have one cosmology constant? The physicists wish to use fundamental principle to predict that number. And then that's where string theorists come into the story. The string theorists, after they become to be very interested in realizing inflation or studying cosmology in general, they find something called the landscape. Ooh, the landscape is basically says, well, if I want to competitify my Clavial, which is the sixth dimension that should curl up because we haven't seen them. And there are so many ways to competitify them that you would actually have 10 to the 500 at least, at the lowest possible estimate, this much different kind of universe. So now, you know, realize 10 to the 120 different rho lambda in 10 to the 50, no problem. So that's one that Leonard Susskind become very excited about this, and then the anthropic principle has a flavor of string theory. And he wrote this book called A Cosmic Landscape, popular book. I loved it. I strongly recommended you to read it as a bedtime story. So I promise I'll entertain you about this. So I'll quote one of my favorite stories from his book. He says that, imagine that there is a sea. Once upon a time, there is an ocean, And underneath the ocean, there are these big-headed fish. And these are the fish that only survive in the middle of the ocean. They don't know there's things above the ocean. They don't know there is things below the ocean. Nevertheless, these are very smart, big-headed fish. So then there's a group of them. They began to think about the philosophical things, and they tried to find the answers. And among them, there's a group of them, call them as physicists. And they start studying the, you know, physics about their environment. And then they begin to wonder a very important problem. How come the temperature of the water is not too hot, not too warm, but just right so that we can swim around freely? They find no answer. Until there's another group of these big-headed fish called the cosmologists. They propose that, well, if we study hard enough, we'll discover there is other things. So they have this crazy proposal that they are living in something that is moving around a heat source, but there are also other places moving around the heat source at some different distance. And if they are too close to the heat source, then the water becomes too hot for them to leave. They become boiled fish. And if they are too far distance from the heat source, then the water becomes cold, and then they become frozen fish. And the reason that we are living, we measure the temperature out of the water is just right for us to live, because otherwise we don't live. And the way of, there is lots of different other possible value for the temperature of the water, which is depend on how close you are to the heat source. So I welcome you to read about it. And if you're interested in the cosmology constant problem, Niash and Ghazal, they are a couple. They are active researchers on this topic. And Henry Tai actually just published a paper last December, like last month, on how to relate cosmology constant problem to electroweak scale, which is very exciting. I'll post all the references on Wiki. But let's move on. As I said, now we discussed a lot about this lambda. Then the next thing to discuss would be structure formation. And I have to say that structure, like how galaxy form, that's very difficult research area that is very active, and they really try to figure out how to. What we actually are going to study is really, suppose in the universe there is one part of region suddenly become slightly overdensed. How would this region evolve? And we'll just study the seed of the density fluctuation and then see how they evolve, because we know gravitational, like having a perfect homogeneous universe is unstable. Like if any place is slightly overdensed, it's going to draw material from the slightly underdense. It's a runaway problem. So we'll worry about why the initial condition is such that there is some inhomogeneity. But let's assume if we find such an overdensed region, how it's going to evolve. So that's what our focus. And once you know there is, then they start to be overdensed, how they are going to form galaxies. I can find some books to recommend, but we're not going to talk about it in class. So we're going to start with a bluntly wrong assumption. So, but it will make our life much easier, though. We can calculate this very well. And of course, our job later is try to correct this assumption and hopefully make a, you know, close to correct calculation. But this is a bluntly wrong calculation. but it will make our life much, much easier. We're going to assume a static universe. Homogeneous, except the little part, we're going to make it slightly overdense. And then there is the matter universe. So let's ignore other components too. So this is what we're going to study. In order to study what I said, which is this density fluctuation, let's define some very reasonable variables, which is rho bar, which is nothing, take our rho, now that it's slightly different someplace, and then we take an average of it. Of course, that still depends on time. And then we'll define this third thing, which is rho minus rho bar divided by rho bar. So that's just a dimensionless fluctuation. That's the average value of the density. And note that this delta is certainly bounded below by minus 1. You can't underdense such that you take everything away. But the upper value is really, can be anything really. Like, for example, me standing here, a human being, is about a 10 to the 30 fluctuation coming compared to the critical density. So this could be at least as large as 10 to the 30. But of course, we are going to do a lot of linear studies. So we're going to study when it's much smaller than 1. So that's our assumption. Is that we're not going to worry about what happens it beyond our linear scope. OK, so let's study this by taking our favorite approach, which is drawing a sphere, drawing a Newtonian sphere. I think we're going to do it at least one more time this afternoon in the tutorial, but maybe some more times. So here we have yet again some Newtonian sphere. And the assumption is, of course, that inside the sphere, we have a density rho bar times 1 plus delta, where delta is positive. It's a slightly overdense region. Outside the sphere, they just have rho bar. So that's our sphere. Having the sphere as u rho, we're going to study this dust particle on the sphere. And we have done this some time. R double dot is given by Gm. And I can write Gm, G delta m, which is the excess, because we assume it's a static homogeneous universe. So if it's not excess, it's not going to contribute to the motion. That's why we make such silly assumptions. But if that's true, that's the density, and that's the volume. And we can cancel one r away. So this would be the Newton's second law. It just says we have some excess of matter. Let's figure out what's the effect of this excess matter on that dust particle. Yeah, it looks pretty much like what you did before, except we replace the rho by rho bar delta. Okay, the next thing, it seems always the thing we do, we use Newton's second law. So the next thing we are going to do is using a continuity equation coming from the conservation law. We assume that the mass is conserved. So that's the density times volume. And what do we try to get out of this? You see, The R that we're trying to find is this R0, which is determined by without the x's, just erase the delta, you can solve something that's called R0. But this thing should be proportional 1 plus delta to the minus 1/3. Yeah? So, oh, you can say this one should be proportional 1 over R cubed to cancel it out because the mass is a constant. The next step is why we assume delta is small, because of course we like to express it as a linear relationship. So we're going to do linear expansion. And then we're just going to take a 2 derivative. The first term disappears, the second term is here. R0 and R in the first order, in the zeros order, it's the same. So we have this coming from mass conservation. And now, of course, what we do is to combine them together. So we have this guy coming from Newton's second law. Should be very recognizable. Just replace rho by the excess of rho. And this coming from mass conservation, basically what we realize that if you have a little excess of mass, then which means mass is conserved, then your radius must be slightly smaller. Combine them together, the R would cancels out, so we will actually get a 4 pi g rho bar delta equals delta delta, double delta. So this is what we want to get out of this study. Yep.
I don't understand what you mean by mass conservation in this case.
It just means that if you take a ball and we say that the slightly over-densed region is compensated by the radius is shrinking such that in this ball, the mass is conserved. So if you assume rho bar is 0, like there's no other density, and then now we have a small amount of density, and now like all exist within the ball, and then if we study how it evolves, then the radius will become smaller under self-gravity, and then the whatever is in the ball is still in the ball. So we assume that there's no particle production, basically. Okay, shall we stop and questions so far? So we make some crazy assumption, it's static, so that we only worry about the excess of the density. We always assume it's homogeneous. And we also says we only study, they all grow from really, really teeny inhomogeneity, and then we want to study how this teeny fluctuation of the density will evolve. And now we have an evolution equation of delta given here. Yeah? Shall we carry on? Okay. So look at our equation. You should find it very familiar. That can somebody solve this equation for me? Come on. Is delta double dot equals some number times delta? The exponential. And how many of them?
Either decaying or expanding.
Very good. So the solution of this, well, very familiar ways, which is 2-exponential. It's written in a funny way, because this thing called the t-dynamical basically tells us that the characteristic scale of this time that it's going to expand by a factor of e is given by this. Let's see, doing 2-derivative. We'll bring 1/t^2, which is right. Okay. So this is what we conclude, is that the density should have exponential growth because the decay mode, it's adding together. So the decay mode, after you wait for some time, will disappear. Okay, there is some small problem, is that let's, for example, take the air density and plug in this formula. So just air density right around us. And then what you get to the scale, the time scale of this air and growing exponential growth is about 8 hours. So it's like every 8 hours, if the air around us has some slightly overdense region, it should double. And another 8 hours and double again. That doesn't sound right. That means if I just wait for like at most a week, like if there is once there's a wind, then the whole air around us should just go collapse, all condense them into themselves into like a big air balls. That doesn't happen. That we observe every day that around us that doesn't happen. So one of our assumptions must be the problem that we didn't die because all the air that go recollapse around us in a few days. So what did we forget? So if you try to squeeze some air together,
pressure.
Yeah, it's not that easy, right? Pressure. So we always take them these. So far in our course, we have happily take W almost equals to zero and do our calculation. But when you study structure formation, it's a battle between the self-gravity and the pressure gradient to counteract it. So you really can't ignore the pressure. So this pressure is given by P. P is equals to this. And the rho is equals to nm, which this m is the mass of the particle we're interested in. And of course, the equation of state is given by p over rho, which in, of course, it's very small if you consider temperature of even, like today's temperature, it's very, very small for any particle. And this is almost, really almost zero. But unfortunately in our case, or fortunately in our case, we shouldn't ignore the pressure, because pressure gradient will give us a force to counteract the gravity force such that it doesn't go like collapse within, you know, a few of that time scale. But the pressure takes time to build up. It doesn't just automatically have this pressure gradient and we're in equilibrium again, and it's very happily ever after. It takes time. So the time take pressure to build up is of course the distance and divided by how fast the pressure travels. And that's the speed of sound. Because what is sound? Sound is nothing but variation of pressure propagating to you. Okay, let's see. Maybe I can do it. So, speaking of sound, I can do it the two ways. If you just do dimensional analysis, actually remember to take care of all the units, you'll realize this is speed of sound. To derive it, we need a little fluid dynamics. Are you happy with dimensional analysis? Okay, we're convinced. Anyway, there is an appendix in the lecture notes that says if you study a cube of air, you will arrive at a wave equation, and you will get at the speed of sound. Okay, so for us, it's very nice. It's just square root of a W. Okay, so now what do we want is, of course, want the pressure as the time scale to be smaller than the recollapse scale time. So we have two time, and then we want, if we don't want it to be recollapse, then we want the pressure gradient to build up faster than the recollapsing. So this gives us, I'll just write it as T dynamical. And then you can move this over, and then you can do it a very carefully study. Then somehow the effect of 2 pi pops out. But this thing is known as the Jean radius. It says if you have a density fluctuation, and if then there's pressure, so they will compete. And this is the deciding radius of who wins the battle. If you are larger than this radius, then it wouldn't, the collapsing will win. So if you have a sphere larger than the Jean radius, it will win, and it will collapse. And if you're smaller, then the pressure gradient will win. The pressure gradient will build up with your fluctuations. So they are really just fluctuations. They are actually the sound wave. So if R bigger than RG, then fluctuation wins. And the girl. And then if R is smaller than RG, then pressure gradient builds up. And we have sound wave.
Fluctuations, do you mean it will collapse?
Yeah. And the collapse. But once, like, because we're doing third term much smaller than one, so collapse is what eventually is going to happen. So by our analysis, assuming third term smaller than one, we would never predict it's going. We just, it grows out of control, that we don't know what's happening. But yes, it will collapse. So now I can advertise this afternoon's tutorial, because you guys are going to study the very important case of getting rid of this assumption. So you guys are going to do this analysis again in the expanding universe. I mean, if a universe expanding, it definitely has some impact on density in general, because as universe expands, that everything become like the density becomes smaller. So then there will be a competition. Then there is this dynamical scale that density likes to grow, that is characterized by this thing. But then there is also the universe expansion. And of course, let's do the simplest thing again is, let's try to hope it's not a competing problem. That's always what we hope. If there is more than one effect that are important, let's try to figure out if I can pick one, ignore the rest. That worked pretty well when we solve freedom equation. There's always something dominant, except, you know, like a very small amount of time. Okay, let's do that. Whoa, yet again, we write down the freedom equation. Let's just assume we are living in a flat universe for now, for a long time, because we already make the argument that the curvature wouldn't matter in any epoch anyway. Okay, so what's the character scale for universe expand? That we have done in the first tutorial. Because each guy has a unit of 1 over time. So the time for universe to expand is equals to 1 over h, which just flip that thing. And now we can compare with this guy we calculated over here. I'll move that guy over. So T dynamical is this guy. Okay, I hope I didn't do this wrong. Okay. So, too bad. This is pretty darn close. And so trying to claim this number is much, much larger than 1. It's not gonna work. So that will be up to you guys this afternoon to taking care of this very important question is, after all, what we wonder is about how density fluctuations behave in this expanding universe. The very interesting result is that it depends on which epoch. Well, so in radiation domination epoch, you will find some results. And then for matter domination era, you'll find some other results. And for the lambda domination, you'll also find some results. And they are different. So it depends on how old the universe is and which component of the universe is dominating. Actually, density fluctuation behaves differently. Since our goal is to figure out for them to grow so they can form structures so we exist, so it's very important to figure out which era actually the density fluctuation grow appreciably. Okay, I'll see you this afternoon.